don't know why. We may not be perfect, but heaven knows we try. But all around, even our old friends put us down. Let's drop the big one and see what happens. We give them money, but are they grateful? No, they're spiteful and they're hateful. They don't respect us, so let's surprise them. We'll drop the big one and pulverize them. Asia's crowded and Europe's too old. Africa's far too hot and Canada's too cold. And South America stole our name. Let's drop the big one, there'll be no one left to blame us. We'll save Australia. An amusement park there. They got surfing too. Boom goes London and boom Paris. More room for you and more room for me. In every city, the whole world round, will just be another American town. Oh, how peaceful it will be. We'll set everybody free. You wear a Japanese kimono, baby, be Italian shoes for me. They all hate us anyhow, so let's drop the big one now. Let's drop the big one now.
The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London.
Good night and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Okay, well, we made it to a Wednesday, and I guess this week, you know, we'll take it because you never know what's coming. It was just moments before we went on the air yesterday that Donald Trump made his statement about the fire and the fury, and because I was on the air already, I didn't hear it, but reading it in a tweet from the Associated Press and all the thousands of other people who tweeted it out in the moments afterwards still doesn't prepare you when you hear the guy who inexplicably was elected president say these words.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. He has been very threatening beyond a normal statement. And as I said, they will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before.
You know,
thank you.
Thank you. And all of us, I think, were left wondering after that statement if that was scripted, if that was something prepared, if that was something that those words, I mean, fire and fury, it's a little too alliterative for Trump to come up with on his own. But apparently he did. This is Glenn Thrush speaking on, I think, MSNBC just an hour or so ago.
For those of us who kind of watched this thing, watched his statement yesterday as if it were the Zapruder film, frame by frame, you could see him peer down at a document that was on the desk. He was attending
right.
an opioid
conference. So I thought he was reading something. Reading
it turns
guidance,
out,
perhaps.
It was just the fact sheet for the opioid event. The fire and fury comment was, I think it was something they were batting around all day. The president, since the 15-0 vote in the UN Security Council, the president has been getting more and more worked up about this. So there were a number of meetings specific to Korea, plus his presidential daily briefing. But I was told he was informed of the Washington Post story, which disclosed that the North Koreans had achieved miniaturization of nuclear warheads. He'd gotten really riled up. They had told him to expect to talk about it, but that was the extent of the briefing. And interestingly enough, his new chief of staff, John Kelly, knew that he was broadly going to speak about this, knew that he was going to speak with some force, but was, in the words of one close aide, surprised that the president made that statement.
Surprised that he made that statement. So nobody knew he was going to use those words or go that far overboard in his threat. I mean, my God, Donald Trump threatened a nuclear war with North Korea. Now, you know, you got to want, because this is, because he speaks in hyperbole, because this is what he does. You have to wonder if he realizes how far he took it. Think about it. The likes of which we have never seen before. Guess what? That's a phrase that he uses, sort of like, you know, the "it'll make your head spin" phrase. He uses this one too.
The grassroots movement, the likes of which the world has never seen before.
We're all part of this very historic movement, a movement the likes of which, actually, the world has never seen before. Aye.
Unemployment is the lowest it's been in 17 years. Business enthusiasm is about as high as they've ever seen. We're being very, very strong on our southern border. And I would say the likes of which this country certainly has never seen.
Yeah, never seen before. So that, you know, he speaks in those terms. He's the best at everything. Everything, you know, he delivered the best speech ever to the Boy Scouts. He does. He had the biggest inauguration crowds in history. Everything is the biggest, the best, the likes of which the world has never seen before. So does he know what he did? Now, there's a tape that was making the rounds today. It was from 1999. For whatever reason, Donald Trump was on Meet the Press with Tim Russert, and they were talking about North Korea. And I hate to say it, he was actually making a little bit of sense back then.
One is North Korea. And you say that you, as president, would be willing to launch a preemptive strike.
Not here. Not preemptive strike. That's not sense.
First, I'd negotiate. I would negotiate here like crazy, and I'd make sure that we tried to get the best deal possible. Look, Tim, if a man walks up to you in a street in Washington, because this doesn't happen, of course, in New York, but if a man walks up and puts a gun to your head and says, give me your money, wouldn't you rather know where he's coming from before he had the gun in his hand? And these people in 3 or 4 years are going to be having nuclear weapons. They're going to have those weapons pointed all over the world and specifically at the United States. And wouldn't you be better off solving this really potentially unbelievable and the biggest problem? I mean, we can talk about the economy. We can talk about Social Security. The biggest problem this world has is nuclear proliferation. And we have a country out there in North Korea, which is sort of wacko, which is not a bunch of dummies. And they are going out and they are developing nuclear weapons. And they're not doing it because they're having fun doing it. They're doing it for a reason. And wouldn't it be good to sit down and really negotiate something, and ideally negotiate? Now, if that negotiation doesn't work, you better solve the problem now than solve it later, Tim. And you know it, and every politician knows it, and nobody wants to talk about it. Jimmy Carter, who I really like.
He likes.
He went over there. It was so soft. These people are laughing at us.
The former general of the Air Force, Merrill McPeak, the former Secretary of Defense, Les Aspin, said you could not launch a preemptive strike against North Korea because the nuclear fallout could be devastating to the Asian Peninsula.
I'm not talking about us using nuclear weapons. Uh-huh. I'm saying that they have areas where they're developing missiles.
No, but taking out their nuclear potential would create a fallout.
Tim, do you know that this country went out and gave them nuclear reactors, free fuel for 10 years? We virtually tried to bribe them into stopping, and they're continuing to do what they're doing, and they're laughing at us. They think we're a bunch of dummies. I'm saying that we have to do something to stop.
But if the military told you, Mr. Trump, we can't do this.
You give me two names. You're giving me two names. I don't know. Do you want to do it in 5 years when they have warheads all over the place, every one of them pointing to New York City, to Washington, and every one of our... Is that when you want to do it, or do you want to do something now?
You know, the fact of the matter is, we were trying to do this, you know, measured diplomacy, which with North Korea did not work. So here we are. Here we are. But do you fight? And there are many who say that Kim Jong-un is not a madman. I beg to differ. I think he's pretty mad. But, you know, do you wait for him to do what he's going to do? I don't know what the answer is. I'm not a great military mind. But then again, neither is Donald Trump. So there are some who are saying, well, you know, maybe he's channeling, you know, the Nixon madman theory. Do you remember about that? Or Eisenhower? Well, Michael Beschloss, the presidential historian, drew some parallels or actually pointed out the differences between the Nixon madman theory and the madman that is Donald Trump.
The madman theory idea was that, you know, it is a strategic asset for a president to seem unpredictable. And as you know, in 1972 at Christmas time, Nixon bombed, you know, enormous bombing of North Vietnam, trying to move the North Vietnamese to negotiate. And presidential aides, you know, were caught saying to reporters, you know, off the record or on background, you never know what the president might do. So, you know, that was something that did happen. But nowadays, I think what Nixon would say is, I never used language like fire and fury. I always tried to moderate crises, not escalate them. That's what Dwight Eisenhower used to do when Nikita Khrushchev used to go out and roar about saying, we're going to send the missiles flying over New York City and we will bury you. Eisenhower said, you know, the way that we show strength is to be mild and quiet.
There are some who are saying that, you know, maybe he's trying to channel Truman. The thing is, they were totally different situations, but listen to the similarities in the rhetoric.
They may expect a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on this earth.
They will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before.
And the thing is, I don't think Donald Trump knows enough of history to know that Harry Truman was speaking in between the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. By the way, today, 72 years ago, the U.S. dropped the bomb on Nagasaki, Japan. How weird is it? Today, August 9th, it was 43 years ago today that Richard Nixon resigned. I don't think we'll be so lucky to have history repeat on this day, but maybe sometime soon. Anyway, it makes you wonder when you hear Donald Trump say things like,
we'll handle North Korea. We're going to be able to handle them. It will be handled. We handle everything. Thank you very much.
He says that, and then he goes to the fire and the fury. And again, now we know that nobody, none of his senior, I was going to say lieutenants, but I guess I should say generals, knew this was coming. They had no idea. Rex Tillerson certainly didn't know. Actually, this morning, Rex Tillerson was on a plane on his way to Guam to refuel before heading back home. And it was on the plane on the way to Guam, which, by the way, Kim Jong-un had threatened, not so much from what I've read in response to Trump's fire and fury statement, but the sanctions that were passed in the UN Security Council on Saturday, that he's threatening Guam. But even then, Tillerson was trying to tamp down the hysteria. I guess it's hysteria. I'm a bit hysterical over it. I'm freaked out. I'm wondering if you're as freaked out as I am today. Here's a little bit of Rex Tillerson. He was asked, have Russia and China been helpful in any way in the negotiations with North Korea?
Well, I haven't spoken to them since we left Manila, which was, I guess, about a day and a half ago. But we had direct discussions in Manila about the situation. I know that they were having talks as well with a representative from North Korea. I think that is evidence that they have very good open channels of communication to be able to talk to the regime in North Korea. And we hope that they will be encouraging them to stand down their program, to abide by the UN Security Council resolutions, which both China and Russia have voted for in the past. So I'm hopeful that they can use their influence, and I believe they do have influence with the regime, to bring them to a point of dialogue, but with the right expectation of what that dialogue will entail.
I've got more of that in today's What's News, which we'll have coming up in a few minutes. But I want to share with you an article that ran in The Nation about 2 or 3 weeks ago. It was July 24th, and it was entitled, "Do You Trust Donald Trump's Finger on the Nuclear Button?" And maybe I'm naive about certain things, but there's a couple of things that I did not realize. So let me share this with you. It was written by Mark Hertzgard. And if you're feeling as chilled as I am today, this is information you need to know. And the basic gist of it is, unlike declaring war, like a regular general, just, you know, regular bombs as opposed to nuclear bomb war, the president needs the approval of Congress. But if he wants to launch a nuclear strike, not so much. Here we go. "The United States is not a monarchy," he writes, "but in times of nuclear crisis, it sure feels like one. In his capacity as commander-in-chief, the president of the United States has sole authority over whether to launch a nuclear strike. He does not need to consult his military advisors. He does not need approval from Congress. It is his call alone. That's a risky protocol under any circumstances. But when the Oval Office is occupied by someone with the temperament of Donald Trump, it should trouble Americans of all political persuasions. This is especially true when the United States confronts an adversary whose own leader, North Korea's Kim Jong-un, seems to be itching for a fight. The Korean conflict is escalating by the day as the two men's macho posturing intensifies. We are fast approaching a situation like the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, when the U.S. and Soviet Union came perilously close to blowing each other to bits. It's imperative to immediately ratchet down tensions between the U.S. and North Korea, and above all, to make sure no nuclear weapons are fired. Even a single nuclear blast would unleash inconceivable death and destruction," James Clapper, the former director of National Intelligence, told CNN. "To lessen the chances of catastrophe on the U.S. side, senior leaders in Congress from both parties should immediately communicate to the White House that the president must not launch a nuclear first strike without obtaining a congressional declaration of war. Congressional leaders should also urge the president's top military advisors, Secretary of Defense, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the National Security Advisor, to take all measures available to assure that the president does not launch a nuclear attack without the advisors' express agreement that such an attack is unavoidable to protect the American homeland. Meanwhile, efforts to engage in diplomatic dialogue with North Korea, aided by its sponsor state and neighbor China, which doesn't want nuclear war either, must redouble. Whoever might start it, everyone loses in a nuclear war. It is by no means clear that Donald Trump understands this core truth of the nuclear era. Until he does, we need to get his finger off the nuclear button, or at least broaden the circle of officials with the authority to make that awesome decision. We need to demand dialogue rather than escalation. Public servants with inside influence should be sending this message loudly and clearly to the White House, and so should ordinary citizens. Now is the time for marches in the streets, urging no nuclear war, and especially no first strike." Leave politics and ideology aside for the moment. This is not a partisan plea. It is not a call to lower America's guard against a potential nuclear attack by North Korea, which is an undeniably dangerous and nasty regime. But North Korea now has the capacity to strike the U.S. mainland with a nuclear weapon, according to the Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency and independent analysts, and that changes everything. The United States must proceed with steadiness and resolve, but also reason and prudence. Alas, the current commander-in-chief demonstrates none of these qualities. Common sense dictates that a president with Donald Trump's volatile temperament and erratic judgment should not be empowered to single-handedly start a nuclear war. At present, U.S. law and longstanding policy give President Trump unilateral, unstoppable authority to launch a nuclear attack. That needs to be underlined. He need not present a compelling reason for such an attack. Perhaps he simply decides that it's time to teach North Korea a lesson. He need not notify, much less obtain agreement from, leaders in Congress or the Secretary of Defense or other military officials. Trump's status as commander-in-chief empowers him and him alone to unleash nuclear weapons at a moment's notice. 700 strategic warheads in silos and submarines are poised for immediate launch, and the president has absolute, unchecked authority to order their launch with a single verbal command to the Pentagon War Room. That's according to Bruce Blair, a former nuclear launch officer for the U.S. Air Force and current scholar with Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. He told that to The Nation. Trump need only turn to the military officer who carries the nuclear code suitcase, who's never more than a few feet away. The officer opens the suitcase, you know, the so-called football. Trump makes one phone call authenticating his identity, and he orders the warheads unleashed. Warheads that, once launched, cannot be called back. 4 minutes after he gave the order, missiles would fly. 30 minutes later, they would explode on their targets, explained Joe Cirincione, a former staff member of the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Armed Services and current president of the Plowshares Fund. Hundreds of targets. As quickly as he could post a tweet, Trump could destroy human civilization. All U.S. presidents of nuclear age have possessed the same awesome, unfettered authority Trump currently holds. But none of those presidents, with the possible exception of Richard Nixon during the darkest days of Watergate, displayed the psychological profile of the current commander-in-chief. Donald Trump has shown himself time and again to be easily baited and quick to lash out, dismissive of expert consultation, and ill-informed of even basic military and international affairs, including, most especially, nuclear weapons. That's stated in a public letter that Blair and nine other former U.S. nuclear launch officers released a month before the 2016 presidential election. Could the military veto an ill-advised attack order from Trump? There is precedent. When Nixon was brooding and drinking heavily in the final months of his presidency, Defense Secretary James Schlesinger reportedly instructed the Joint Chiefs of Staff that, quote, any emergency order coming from the president should first be cleared with Schlesinger or the Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger. Have Trump's Secretary of Defense or the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff implemented any similar measures? The Pentagon Press Office declined to comment. Defense Secretary Mattis and Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Dunford are sober, prudent, and intelligent individuals who must be concerned about Trump's impulsiveness and have surely considered how to ensure that he does not make a bad nuclear call, said Blair. They may well have taken extraordinary steps to ensure that a presidential command to use nuclear weapons would require their approval under unusual circumstances, e.g., out of the blue, the president orders a preventive nuclear strike against, say, North Korea. Stephen Pfeiffer, an arms control expert at the Brookings Institution, also praised Mattis and Dunford as, quote, sober-minded individuals who, quote, might try to intercede if they saw an inappropriate order. However, Pfeiffer stressed, the system is not designed to give others a veto over a presidential decision. The system then must be changed. Set aside political ideology and partisan calculations for the moment. For the sake of the nation and indeed humanity, it is imperative to reform U.S. nuclear weapons policy. Start with three concrete common sense measures. The United States should take its nuclear weapons off of hair trigger status. It should declare a policy of no first use of nuclear weapons, and it should prohibit this or any president from unilaterally launching a nuclear attack. Instead, it should require the president to act in concert with military and congressional leaders, except under exceptional circumstances such as an adversary's imminent nuclear attack. Launching a nuclear attack is a decision so momentous for all of civilization that it should have all kinds of checks and balances on executive powers called for by our Constitution. That from William Perry, the U.S. Defense Secretary from 94 to 97. Perry has urged Congress to pass the Restricting First Use of Nuclear Weapons Act of 2017, which was introduced in January by Senator Edward Markey of Massachusetts and Congressman Ted Lieu of California. I just heard Pramaya Jayapal of California has also signed on to it, among others, to bring Congress into the decision-making loop and prohibit the president from acting unilaterally. The bill stipulates that the president may not use the armed forces of the United States to conduct a first use nuclear strike unless such strike is conducted pursuant to a declaration of war by Congress that expressly authorizes such a strike. In addition to passing Markey-Lieu, the single most important other step would be to take our nuclear weapons off hair trigger alert, said Cirincione. Currently, 4 minutes after Donald Trump gives an order, hundreds of nuclear warheads could be launched. Each of them is many times more powerful than the bombs that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This is insane. There is no need for this rapid launch capability. Having our missiles ready to launch in hours, days, or weeks instead of seconds would provide some time for reflection, debate, and possible reversal of a launch command. Secretary Mattis could do the nation a great service by recommending in his nuclear posture review due out late this year that this Cold War practice be ended. None of these reforms will happen, though, without strong, sustained public pressure. Removing nuclear weapons from hair trigger alert, adopting a no first use policy, and passing the Markey Lou legislation will require grassroots energy and political will that, until Trump, has been dormant for decades. Meredith Horowski, the global campaign director for the NGO Global Zero, told the nation. Now many Americans are waking up to the nuclear danger posed by Donald Trump, she said. That's why in the coming weeks, Global Zero and partners are mounting new large-scale grassroots campaigns of students, activists, community leaders, universities, institutions, cities, and elected officials to powerfully reject Donald Trump's sole authority to launch us into nuclear war. The campaign is slated to begin with a day of action in Washington, D.C. on September 25th. But as an aside, I saw there's a protest at the White House tonight with Global Zero and a number of other groups. And the article concludes with this paragraph. There is no more urgent issue confronting the nation than Donald Trump and the nuclear button. Climate change, which likewise poses an existential threat to civilization, does not have such a short fuse. Fights over health care, immigration, budgets, and taxes, these can be won or lost today, but resumed tomorrow. Go wrong with nuclear weapons, and there may be no tomorrow. There may be no tomorrow. Again, this is an article. I'll post it on the blog after the show at NicoleSandler.com. Do you trust Donald Trump's finger on the nuclear button? It was published at TheNation.com, written by Mark Hertzgard on July 24th. There may be no tomorrow. We'll take a break. We'll get what's news out of the way, and then we're going to come back and talk about the what our guest David Atkins calls the mutually assured destruction of the left. And we are assured to destruct if we don't get our shit together. So stick around. I'm Nicole Sandler. It's the Nicole Sandler Show. I read the news
today. Oh boy. It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
On Tuesday afternoon, reports surfaced saying that North Korea had succeeded in producing a miniaturized nuclear warhead that can fit inside its intercontinental ballistic missiles.
U.S. intelligence now assesses that North Korea has successfully miniaturized a nuclear weapon. In other words, built a warhead small enough to fit atop a missile, which is a significant milestone in nuclear weapons development and really increases the threat profile of North Korea to the United States, especially coming on the heels of that missile test last month of a missile that many experts assess could reach the U.S. mainland.
Does this mean that the North has fielded a nuclear-tipped weapon?
No, it doesn't mean that yet. It's a significant development along that path, but there are other technological hurdles, our sources say, to doing that. You have to be able to build a missile and a warhead that survives re-entry, and you have to have a reliable delivery system, and it's not clear that the North has that. But of course, U.S. intelligence insights into North Korea are very limited. We don't know what we don't know, and so there's significant question at this moment as to what their capabilities actually are. This assessment really speeds up the timetable and suggests that they've achieved miniaturization much sooner than previously had been understood.
Just a few hours later, the president weighed in with a bombastic response.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. He has been very threatening beyond a normal statement. And as I said, they will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The response from Capitol Hill came swiftly. Senator John McCain on a radio interview at KTAR in Phoenix.
The great leaders that I have seen
they don't threaten unless they are ready to act.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that President Trump is ready to act. And so maybe it'll turn out all right. He's the president. I'm not. But I don't think that some of the great leaders that I have admired would have taken that same path.
Senator Dianne Feinstein of California said the United States must quickly engage North Korea in a high-level dialogue without any preconditions. She also added that she hoped Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was discussing the possibility of reopening talks with the U.S.'s Asian partners during his current trip to Asia. In my view, she said, diplomacy is the only sound path forward. Well, on Wednesday morning, Rex Tillerson was on a plane headed for Guam, which was threatened by North Korea as a response to Trump's statement, for refueling on his way home when he spoke with the press.
You know, the U.S. and the international community with respect to North Korea has actually had a pretty good week. We had a unanimous U.N. Security Council resolution to strengthen sanctions against North Korea, with China and Russia joining us in that vote. And then at ASEAN, there were a lot of strong statements coming out of ASEAN that I think also reinforced that the global community has expressed its view that North Korea really needs to stand down this program. So I think in response to that, the North Koreans' rhetoric has just ratcheted up louder and louder and more threatening. So I think the president, what the president is doing is sending a strong message to North Korea in language that Kim Jong-un would understand, because he doesn't seem to understand diplomatic language. And I think the president just wanted to be clear to the North Korean regime that the U.S., you know, unquestionable ability to defend itself, will defend itself and its allies. And I think it was important that he deliver that message to avoid any miscalculation on their part.
The Q&A with Tillerson on the plane continued.
Do you have any advice for Americans? Should they be worried?
I think Americans should sleep well at night. I have no concerns about this particular rhetoric of the last few days. I think the president, again, as commander-in-chief, I think he felt it necessary to issue a very strong statement directly to North Korea. But I think what the president was just reaffirming is the United States has the capability to fully defend itself from any attack and defend our allies, and we will do so. And so the American people should sleep well at night.
It should be noted that Wednesday, August 9th, is the 72nd anniversary of the U.S. dropping an atomic bomb on Nagasaki, Japan. The president on Tuesday met with health and administration officials and briefly addressed the press on the subject of opioid addiction in the U.S. As the crisis intensifies and an average of 142 Americans die of overdoses each day, Trump isn't ready to declare a national emergency, as was recommended by his commission on the issue.
The best way to prevent drug addiction and overdoses to prevent people from abusing drugs in the first place. If they don't start, they won't have a problem. If they do start, it's awfully tough to get off. So we can keep them from going on, and maybe by talking to youth and telling them no good, really bad for you in every way. But if they don't start, it will never be a problem.
And that's a bit of What's News for Now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you enjoy these reports, I hope you'll check out The Nicole Sandler Show, Tuesdays through Fridays, here on the Progressive Voices Network, from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern, 12 to 1 Pacific. And the podcast, always available at NicoleSandler.com.
Can't afford a monthly donation? Is that what's getting you down, Bunky? But maybe you shop on Amazon.com occasionally?
Well then, just use the NicoleSandler.com Amazon portal and we'll get a small commission on all your purchases.
But I just bought...
Don't worry, we can't see what you bought.
Just bookmark Amazon through the NicoleSandler.com portal and use it. Every purchase helps Nicole stay on the air.
This is a huge, huge issue.
And we're talking about it. The Nicole Sandler Show on Progressive Voices and NicoleSandler.com.
All right, we are back, and we'll put North Korea and nuclear conflagration to the side for a few minutes to talk about some possible self-destruction on behalf of the Democrats. I'm really excited for our next guest. David Atkins is a contributor to Washington Monthly's Political Animal. He's got bylines at American Prospect, Salon, and elsewhere. He's also the Region 10 Director for the California Democratic Party and president of the Pollux Group, a market research firm. Hey, David.
Hey, happy to be here. Thanks.
Thank you for joining me. You know, you're quite prolific over at the Political Animal, and there are so many things we could have talked about. But as I was reading the other day, your column titled Bernie, Kamala, and the Left's War of Mutually Assured Destruction really caught my eye, because I've been hearing so much about a new war of words between the two, between the Bernie faction and the Hillary faction again. And I try to separate myself from that stuff and just, you know, stay informed about everything that's going on, which is a more than a full-time job these days with the goings-on in the White House. And I didn't even realize this was happening. But when I read your piece, I get it. I get the divide between the very progressive part of the Democratic Party and the more centrist or moderate, or as some would call it, the more conservative parts of the Democratic Party. But it seems like the sides, the dividing line is drawn in more, I don't know, tenser terms than that. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, and we're not just talking about progressive versus moderate. I think some people on the establishment side get offended by that. I think most importantly, it's two sort of different versions of progressivism, one that takes a much stronger sort of stance on the class war, economic issues, and Wall Street, and one that is more aggressive on social issues, but gives a lot wider latitude toward the asset class and capitalism in general. But I mean, ultimately, if we had a parliamentary system in the United States, this wouldn't be a problem. The Democratic Socialists would be able to have their party, and right, the sort of liberals, center left, as it were, would have their party, and those two would form a coalition and disagree where they needed to and agree where they wanted to. We don't have that. And so we have to learn how to get along with each other and join together as a family. And that means respecting one another's priorities, where, if at all possible.
You know, and I see it every day during my show. I usually have two chat rooms going. Today, YouTube is not cooperating, so we're not up on YouTube today. But the YouTube chat room seems to be a little more towards the, because you labeled it that way, the Democratic Socialist side. A lot of those people, they were the never Hillary gang. They just could not bring themselves to vote for Hillary Clinton, even though people like myself and others said, if it's a choice between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, there is no choice. You got to vote for Hillary Clinton. Then we push her. And look, even if Bernie Sanders had won, and I was a big Bernie Sanders supporter, even if Bernie had been the nominee, his whole campaign was based on, you know, winning the election is only the first part of the fight. Then you need to be there at every single juncture to push, to call, to be out in the streets, to do the pushing to get our agenda passed. So why would that be any different, if it was someone who was more conservative or a Democrat but didn't focus on exactly the issues you want them to focus on?
Oh, it wouldn't be, of course. And I would say two things about this. First, the internet tends to amplify the loudest and sometimes the worst voices. Mm. Like you, I voted Sanders in the primary and then Clinton in the general. 90% of Sanders voters voted for Clinton in the general election. That's actually a higher percentage than the Puma Clinton voters in 2008 for Obama. So Sanders folks get a bad rap for not supporting Clinton in the general, just because the election was so close. But it's actually not unusual, the numbers that Sanders voters didn't vote for Clinton. About 10% is pretty standard, and so there wasn't as much as is being claimed. On the other hand, 80% of Democrats, or 82%, have a positive opinion of Sanders. So the Sanders haters out there that you see very vocally on Twitter and elsewhere are also a small percentage. So it's important to realize that some of these ways, this debate is being amplified by the loudest, most extreme voices. But it's also important to note that we are going to have primaries. We're going to have primaries for our congressional elections, and we're going to have a primary for our presidential nominee. And that means that we're going to be, again, hashing out some of these same issues in potentially very ugly ways. And we're going to need to do that in a way that hopefully allows us all to come together, no matter who the nominee is, for whether it's a congressional seat or the presidency. And hopefully, whoever the nominees are, prioritize all of our concerns, whether we're more establishmentarian or whether we're more on the Democratic Socialist side.
David Atkins is with us, and I should say you're at David O. Atkins on Twitter, since a lot of this noise comes on Twitter, so people can find you there. There's another element in this, and I'm wondering if it's just happening earlier this year, because it seems like, I don't know, in political Trump years, it's hard to believe it's only been 200 days into this administration, because it feels like it's been, you know, definitely 3.5 years already, and we're you know, itching for the next presidential election to come up already. Is it more pronounced so early because of the dire situation that we find ourselves in, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. There's recriminations on both sides, because Trump is such a horrible, malignant figure, and because the election was so close, and because you had so many other things thrown into the mix, including, you know, that folks were excited to have the first female president, and Trump is a horrific misogynist, and the sting from that hurts a lot of people. On the Sanders side, of course, the fact that you had an inspiring Democratic socialist and that he was maligned in so many ways after coming fairly close and highlighting a lot of issues that people felt had long been ignored for decades in American politics, you know, that hurts too. And so you have a lot of people with very bruised feelings on both sides of this. And of course, the Sanders people also feel like Bernie would have won, as is the common refrain. And so both sides feel that the other caused this catastrophe of Trump, which heightens the divisions. And without, you know, laying a claim down on one side or the other, puts people at each other's throats in a negative way.
And speaking of at each other's throats, there's a really ugly element to this little divide that's going on now. First, I keep reading about how Bernie Sanders people are attacking Kamala Harris. And it's not only Kamala Harris, as you write in this piece. You got Kamala Harris, you got Cory Booker, and you have Deval Patrick, three people who are already being touted as 2020 possibilities, who all three happen to be African-American. And there are reasons that the far left, the Sanders coalition, as it were, has problems with each of them. And I turned on MSNBC last night and saw a panel discussion, and charges of racism were being thrown out. And it bothered me. I mean, I could see how it would look that way if those are the only three you have problems with. But I could throw out other names of 2020 possible candidates who I think look pretty good on the surface, from Chris Murphy to Kirsten Gillibrand to Andrew Cuomo, although maybe he doesn't look quite as good as they do, or Gavin Newsom. I mean, there are other names out there that, you know, if you throw them into the mix, maybe that lessens the racial component. I have a problem when they go to race, when the issues that people on the left have a problem with have nothing to do with race.
Yeah, well, and this is where you start to get into very delicate territory.
Yes,
but,
you do.
You know, obviously there are a number of white establishment candidates who would have the same problem.
Yeah.
Like Joe Biden, for instance, was long known as Senator DMDNA for his vote on the bankruptcy bill.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge, of course, comes, as I noted in my piece, that the establishment has sort of this vision of the wedding of a centrist, more fiscally moderate donor class that's more comfortable with Wall Street, aligned with the emerging Democratic majority of of a browner, more racially diverse and otherwise ethnically diverse America. And that coalition will join together to be newly empowered. And so, you know, if you have a bunch of white folks, and so it's natural for them to gravitate toward candidates who represent that vision. So if you have someone like a Cory Booker or a Deval Patrick, folks who have managed to navigate their way in spite of institutional racism in America to financial success, in large part through Wall Street, these are going to be seen by the establishment as sort of your perfect candidates, mm-hmm. acceptable candidates to the whole coalition. Whereas a Democratic Socialist is going to say, this person is a stalking horse. This person is, you know, looks good on the outside, but is actually a stalking horse for the interests of the financial elite. That is a recipe for accusations of racism on one side and insiderism on the other. The challenge with the Ryan Cooper piece, for instance, is that when you're only singling out the African-American candidates, when you're not putting Biden and these other folks into the mix, Cuomo especially, for instance, then it looks like you're going after the African-American candidate.
Right, and I can see that.
And we have to admit.
Right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Now, I just say I can see that. I agree with you. But, yeah, continue.
Yeah, so we have to, and we also have to admit that there are, you know, the Bernie bro phenomenon isn't completely made up. And there are some elements that gravitated toward Sanders who are not racially sensitive, to put it mildly, sensitive on issues of gender, to put it mildly. So one of the reasons, and even Sanders himself said very unfortunate things about identity politics, for instance. So, you know, one of the points that I tried to make in the piece is that we have to respect each other's red line. We have to make sure that we're not triggering each other's red line mm-hmm. or looking like we're dismissing them. So on the Sanders side, you can't be dismissing identity politics as less important than class politics, because it's not true, because institutional racism is a problem. Institutional sexism is a problem. And even if you got justice against Wall Street, even if you leveled down the worst iniquities of capitalism, those institutional racism and sexism problems would still be there and still create massive inequities in society. And if you look like you're dismissing them, or you look like you're singling out African-American or candidates of color, that is only going to heighten the divide and reduce the ability of both the establishment and voters of color to listen to the Democratic Socialist message.
Right.
On the other hand, the establishment has a gigantic problem on its hands in that it completely dismisses the red lines of Democratic Socialists and wants to treat them as purity politics or as not legitimate red lines to be drawing. So it's okay to draw a red line, or necessary to draw a red line, on choice or maybe on guns or other issues or on gay rights, which I agree. Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree with those red lines. Draw them. We should not be supporting anti-choice candidates no matter what. But they treat Wall Street issues and free college or universal health care in terms of single payer as not appropriate red lines to be drawing. So, like, I'm sorry, with regard to Deval Patrick, working at Mitt Romney's vulture capital firm, Bain Capital, is a gigantic problem. It is okay
that's
say
a red line.
That's not acceptable.
Right. He's the managing director of Bain Capital. I mean, that's a big red line. Right? So that's legitimate.
Yeah, that's legitimate. And saying, I can't support a candidate who is managing director of Bain Capital is every bit as legitimate as saying, I can't support a candidate who's anti-choice.
Right.
But you've got an establishment that wants to treat one of those as a legitimate red line, but not the other one. And that's sort of what I'm saying. And then, of course, you have Sanders folks who are out there saying, oh, well, you know, abortion's not as important, and we need to give ground on that because what's really important is the class war.
It's Sanders people saying that?
You have some of that.
I was horrified just last week when I read that that seems to be not a red line anymore. I didn't know it was coming from the Sanders people. I thought it was coming from Nancy Pelosi and the establishment Democrats saying that.
I'm gonna take some flack for saying that it is. It has, and Sanders himself has said some negative things about these sorts of issues in the past. And there was the candidate in Oklahoma, I believe it was, who had a poor record on choice.
Yep.
But now you're seeing it come from the DCCC, and somehow the Sanders coalition is getting blamed for the DCCC saying that we should give ground on choice. But my point is, we should be respecting each other's red lines. You shouldn't be dismissing identity politics. It's really important and a huge facet of equality in the United States. But the establishment also has to concede some red lines on some of these Wall Street issues, the issues with like Cory Booker on choice. And it's not that these things should, on school choice, for instance, mm-hmm. it's not that these things should eliminate the possibility of supporting these candidates either, although probably Deval Patrick is a no-go for me just from the start. But, you know, at least, say, a figure like Kamala Harris should have to explain why she chose not to prosecute a Steve Mnuchin.
Right. And that's the issue.
Be held accountable for that.
Right. And a lot of people don't understand what the issue some have with Kamala Harris is. And as Attorney General of the state of California, she did not prosecute Steve Mnuchin for his crimes with One West Bank. And I've done enough shows with David Day and talking about the foreclosure crisis that people, I think, know about it. But Steve Mnuchin was knee deep in the foreclosure scam. And she chose not only not to prosecute him, but she also was the only Democrat who took contributions from him. Now, you're out in California, so you know a lot more about Kamala Harris than I do. That's the issue that people have with her?
It's not the only issue. Because she was a prosecutor, as you can imagine, she made decisions to prosecute things that anger a number of people on the left. But the Steve Mnuchin prosecution problem is, I think, the biggest. And I should say, I like Kamala Harris. I really do. She's very progressive on a large number of issues. And the Steve Mnuchin thing is not a no-go for me. It's just something that I would like to see explained and is a legitimate pressure point, because the reality is the Obama administration from the top down pressured all of its attorneys general not to prosecute on these crimes. Mm. It's frequently said, oh, well, we couldn't have secured convictions. The laws weren't on the books. There wasn't evidence. That's not true. That's absolutely not true. It could have been done. But Kamala Harris wasn't any different from any of the other attorneys general in the United States. The Obama administration pressured them not to do it. I'm not going to go into why, but it was a political decision.
Mm-hmm.
And Kamala Harris, in all likelihood, bowed to that, like every other attorney general in the United States. And I think it's important that going forward, that not be a reason to dismiss her entire candidacy. But it is legitimate for many Democrats who care very much about these issues, and the many, many hundreds of thousands of people that Mnuchin and One West Bank destroyed in their lives through illegal predatory foreclosures,
mm-hmm.
to answer for that and promise that she won't do that the next time. That in a Kamala Harris administration, she will make it a point to prosecute these sorts of crimes. And I think that's all we're asking for. And I think that's a legitimate thing to be talking about.
Without a doubt. Now, the other part of it is, I mean, she's a freshman senator from California. Do we even know? I mean, she may have aspirations to the White House. Do we even know that she's thinking of a 2020 run? Or is this just some people's projections onto her?
I think it's safe to say that she is.
Do you?
But, you know, only she can answer that question
right.
for herself. I wouldn't dare to presume to answer it for her. But, I mean, look, there are a lot of people who are being talked about in presidential terms and who are meeting with donors and doing the things that they would need to do to run. And not all of them will run. Some of them will not run. So it's impossible to say who will and who won't. But, again, to bring it back to the original point, I think – if you have candidates who have a poor record on issues that are related to racial and social inequalities in the country, that those people should be held to account for them,
mm-hmm.
right? You shouldn't have anti-choice candidates. And if a candidate says something that seems to indicate that they don't take these sorts of issues seriously, then they should be held to account for that.
Sure. But David, you
and if, yeah.
No, go finish your thought.
No, and similarly, if people have records that are concerning on issues related to Wall Street and the predatory financial sector, or support for charter schools, or lack of support for single payer health care, or lack or support for, say, fracking or these other issues, that those are legitimate things to put on the table and to hold them to account for. They shouldn't cause us to go into self-conflagration and civil war. They shouldn't be cause to say, I'll never vote for this person, even mm-hmm. against a Republican. But they're legitimate things to talk about in a primary campaign.
They absolutely are. Now, you brought up, David Atkins is with us, you brought up single payer. And that's another thing that the DCCC is reluctant to even go out and endorse in any meaningful way. In fact, I think they shy away from it entirely. These are going to be divides within the Democratic Party, and they're going to be, just as they were in 2016, they're going to be topics for the party platform. But again, what the vitriol that we see, it's like, you know, Democrat on Democrat Twitter wars, is helpful to no one when we're looking at this megalomaniac sociopath crazy man in the White House who's, you know, threatening nuclear war with North Korea. I mean, at some point, people on the left need to say, all right, we need to come together for the greater good, don't we?
Exactly. And that's what I was trying to communicate. It's sort of a path forward, because I think each side wants, and when I say side, again, it's an overestimation of what's actually going on, because the vast majority of actual Democrats are good with each other on all these issues. 90% of Sanders people voted for Clinton. 82% of Democrats love Bernie Sanders. Like, so we're magnifying a smaller set of activists who are upset with each other. That having been said, yes, we are in a crisis. And part of the problem here is we're talking about 2020 presidential candidates when we need to be focused on the 2018 congressional elections, and in some cases, municipal elections before that. We need to be fighting on all fronts at all times. And we need to take back Congress. That's the first order of priority. So we can't be at each other's throats. In terms of moving forward, I think that the worst elements of both sides want to win on their terms. You had folks on a famous podcast use the phrase bend the knee, you know, that they need to bend the knee to us. That's not going to happen.
Like, no.
The establishment side is not going to bend the knee to the Dem socialist side. But you've also got establishment people who are like, Sanders isn't a Democrat. These people aren't Democrats. They lost the primary. They should go away. Like, that's not going to happen.
No, that's not helpful.
Not only is it not going to happen, like, Sanders socialist Democrats have been sweeping into state and local party organizations all over the country. They're only going to get more louder and more influential from here. So we have to figure out a way to come together on terms that everyone can agree with. And I think the easiest way to do that is for everyone to be more cognizant and more accepting of some of the lines in the sand that each other draw, and try to address their concerns in constructive ways rather than trying to dismiss them.
Right. I saw that again the other night, watching one of the panels on MSNBC or CNN, one of them, and somebody brought up Sanders and the Democrats. Oh, I know. They were asking, who is the leader of the Democratic Party? And one of the hosts has an obsession with this. Who is the leader of the Democratic Party? And somebody said, well, right now, probably Bernie Sanders. And two people at the same time said, Bernie Sanders is not a Democrat. We've got to get past that, because if we don't, we're gonna wind up with more of what we have now.
Agreed. Yeah, I mean, just between you and me and all your listeners, I think it would be really helpful if Sanders would just step up and join the party already. But that's absolutely true. We have to move past this sort of sniping and agitating at one another. A number of the Sanders coalition, even if they feel they're being attacked unfairly on this front, certainly give a lot of folks who are, you know, marginalized in our society, women and people of color, a lot of pause. And the rhetoric coming out of the Democratic Socialist side sounds like it is being very dismissive to concerns of marginalized groups. And we need to self-police. I've been guilty of it myself in the past. We need to self-police the way we talk about these things, because no matter what our motivations are, sometimes the way we express things tends to seem like we are not taking those issues seriously.
Right.
And that has to be dealt with. And especially if we're literally saying things that are dismissing issues by, say, negatively referring to identity politics, that has to be self-policed, not just because it's bad for optics, but because it literally makes people from marginalized communities feel like we are not listening to them and not hearing what the problems are in their lives. So that's a very real thing. And of course, as I've said again and again, on the establishment side, part of the reason that you see such anger from the Sanders folks is that the Democratic Socialists feel like our issues have been marginalized for decades now, ever since, you know, the Democrats took their pro-Wall Street turn in the 1980s.
That's right.
That no one's been listening to us for a very, very long time. And we feel like people are finally starting to listen to us, and we want to see some of these issues taken seriously, especially after the Great Recession caused by Wall Street greed and by, frankly, the massive electoral losses by establishment Democrats over the last decade.
That's it. Hey, David Atkins, we're out of time. Thank you so much. It's been a great discussion, and we could keep going for an hour, but the clock is running out. Find him on Twitter at David O. Atkins, and at Washington Monthly, I'll post a link on my blog at NicoleSandler.com. Thank you so much, David. It was great talking with you.
You too. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. Back tomorrow with Howie Klein. Thanks, everyone. Bye.